Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today. First, in microseconds, the union researcher Kevin Skerritt will talk about the politics of pensions. And at the bottom of the hour, Jane McAlevey and Liza Featherstone extend a conversation they started in this show last December about Me Too, a little over a year after Harvey Weinstein got busted. First, pension funds. What do they do with all that money? Are they up to things money held in the name of workers shouldn't be up to? And why do we need giant pension funds at all? Here's Kevin Skerritt, a researcher with the Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, and one of four co-editors of The Contradictions of Pension Fund Capitalism, published by Cornell University Press, to explain. Kevin Skerritt. It is a different country up there by you. How is your retirement scheme all structured? Do you have a public system like ours supplemented with private ones? How's it all work?
We do. The Canadian system has evolved very much in parallel to the U.S. system, although I would say for various political and institutional reasons, ours is stronger. Like the U.S., we have a Social Security-type framework, although structured in two separate public pension plans that are virtually universal. One is literally universal for residents. The other is earnings-based but covers all workers. Together, they represent a kind of equivalent of Social Security, but really inadequate. In fact, in some ways, I would say more inadequate than the U.S. Social Security system. And therefore, in Canada, workers are reliant on supplemental programs. Like in the U.S., we still have some defined benefit pension plans established at the workplace level, but those have been in decline over the last 30 years. Over the neoliberal period, pension coverage in Canada peaked out at around 46% of the workforce. Now it's down to somewhere in the 30s. And if you look at secure defined benefit pensions, it's probably around 25% of Canadian workers and heading downward. So I would say we've hung on, I think, to more defined benefit plans than in the U.S. I think the situation is somewhat worse, but it's very similar. And like in the U.S., the remaining decent defined benefit pension plans are primarily in the public sector.
And as with the U.S. and other countries as well, these private pension funds, or public pension funds as well, have accumulated vast assets, which are major, major players in the world's financial markets. There was a fantasy some time ago, back in the 70s particularly, that these funds held in the name of workers could be used for the benefit of workers. It hasn't really worked out that way, has it?
Absolutely right. And for me, I have to say, coming into this world in the mid-90s inside a public sector union, I frankly shared some of what I now think of as naive hopes and ambitions that as a union and as a labor movement, we could somehow take up a kind of shared control or a union control mandate and utilize essentially investment policies and practices to advance a working class or a trade union agenda in the way that, as you say, people in the 70s and 80s and certain European advocates had suggested we could do. And it's an interesting record looking back because in some ways in Canada in particular, the public sector unions have actually succeeded in negotiating what we call joint trusteeship or joint control, which allows trade unions to name trustees or decision makers on boards that are often 50-50 structured. And that includes boards that oversee investment policy. But as you suggest, the actual impact of that change in many of the large public sector pension funds has been, in my view, minimal. The way I sometimes make this point, I say that development over the last 25 years has had far more impact. The participation of union-named trustees has had far more impact on their thinking about the world than the union trustees has had an impact on the actual behavior of these funds.
Yeah, I would almost say it's almost a law of human psychology that people identify upwards. And so the union people are going to identify with the Wall Street people because they're richer and more successful by conventional measures than the workers. So they're going to identify with the private equity guys and the money managers and not the folks they're supposed to be managing the money on behalf of. I mean, is that a pretty accurate description of what happens?
That is accurate, and it is very much subjective in that way. And add to it that, you know, for the trade union people that end up in this world sitting on these boards and with this kind of access, you know, you really are elevated to a kind of a status that is very attractive in many ways. But I want to argue that in addition to that, there are possibly even more powerful factors that shape people's thinking. And it is very simply this, that when you're in a role as a trustee, you're helping to shape investment policy, you are working in the world as it exists, a world that is increasingly dominated by financial logic and thinking, and in fact, an economy that has been increasingly, as we say, financialized, taken over by these logics. And transformations of asset classes and what these funds get into, all of this is shaped by the movers and shakers of Wall Street and what we call Bay Street in Toronto and London. This is not a trade union world. And when these people seek out or are provided with quote unquote training in how to play these roles, well, where do we go to learn how to do this? Well, of course, they're sent to the only institutions that provide information and knowledge and skills in how to do this, and that is business schools. There are no meaningfully different institutions in the labor movement or elsewhere or academia that would provide people with the skills and the ability to pursue a different course. And the last piece that's very related to that is partly because in addition, this role of pension funds is in North America is very much constrained by the legal apparatus, what is called fiduciary duty, the legal structures that control and in many ways limit and inhibit the room to maneuver. And the way that is simplified is you have an obligation to seek out a maximum risk-adjusted return on your investments. That is your legal obligation. Well, once you've come to learn that this is a practice and a legal doctrine that is virtually universally embraced in the worlds that you're working in, you come to be trained that that's okay, that's the world that you have to live with.
Yeah, as Mike McCarthy points out, both in the chapter that's in your book, but also his own book, when American law was being written, and you go back to the Taft-Hartley bill in the 50s, early 40s, and ERISA in the 70s, they were very, very conscious. The Congress was very, very conscious that there was a danger that union-controlled pension funds would act in the interest of workers and not the capitalist class, and they made clear to write the legislation to make sure that didn't happen. They're really operating on very constrained grounds. No matter what they would like to do in their heart of hearts, there's only so much they could do because of the legal constraints.
That's absolutely right. In fact, some of those legal legislation and legal doctrines have been sharpened and clarified over the years. One example of this, a very large, in fact, the single largest pool of pension fund money in Canada is the one that's held by the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, over $300 billion Canadian dollars. And that fund was reworked and actually financialized, moved into private markets in the late 90s. When the federal government did that, they attached to it a specified, legally structured mandate that reflects that fiduciary obligation that I just said. Their legal mandate is to seek a maximum risk-adjusted rate of return for the fund's beneficiaries, period. And so, of course, whenever there are social concerns or political concerns that are raised, the leadership of that fund simply points to that mandate and says, well, we have to do this.
And as much as one would like to fantasize about changing those rules, look at the model of Sweden and their wage earner funds. In a social democracy with just a policy that was consciously designed to lead to the gradual takeover of corporate Sweden by public money, that all went awry. And Sweden, far more favorable political terrain than the U.S. or Canada for such a dream of peaceful expropriation. If it didn't work in Sweden, you really have to wonder, could labor's capital really be labor's capital anywhere?
Well, I think that's right. And you know, my argument is that that reflects that actually that Meidner plan, that kind of famous episode in Sweden, is in some ways kind of the high point, the highest attempt to actually pursue a plan that was transformational, like using an investment fund. This was the concept to move in essentially an anti-capitalist direction or a social direction. And of course, we know that that not only did that not work out in Sweden, but attempts to pursue similar ideas in other countries, including in Quebec, by the way, have not worked out. The actual practices of funds, even those that have been set up by trade union people. In Canada, we have a set of labor-sponsored investment funds started with the Quebec Solidarity Fund that are actually controlled and overseen by representatives of the labor movement. But and that was, you know, evolved in the 80s and 90s with high hopes of somehow bringing a labor agenda into the investment world. And sadly, the actual outcomes of that have been very much in line with what happens in the standard private financial markets, of course, reflecting the fact that these remain private, for-profit, capitalist institutions seeking a rate of return. That is their reason for existing. And you know, one of my arguments is that if we want something that's not going to end up that way, it's going to have to be structured in some qualitatively different way that's not simply embedded in the existing financial markets.
I'm speaking with union researcher Kevin Skerritt. Yeah, I want to return to that towards the end of the interview, but one thing I'd like to talk about now is some of the uses to which these funds are being put. I have next to me a press release that came from Heartland Capital Strategies, mobilizing workers' capital for a sustainable world, which sounds like a marvelous aspiration. But they're announcing a deal for union money, Ulico, a union-sponsored life insurance company it started out as, along with the private equity group, the Carlyle Group, to invest pension funds in the reworking rehabilitation of Kennedy Airport here in New York. That is basic infrastructure. Kennedy Airport is owned by an authority, that it is a public authority of weird hybrid kind of public-private authority, but it is essentially a public authority. But here we have public infrastructure work being done with private money and unions participating. I think this kind of thing is quite common in Canada now, right? I think it's just starting to hit the shores here, but it's pretty common in Canada, right?
It is, and this is actually the issue that I've spent a lot of my time and focus writing on and reporting on, because actually that press release you're looking at, that deal that was just announced for the redevelopment of JFK on a public-private partnership basis, is, as you say, very much reflective of a model for infrastructure investment that has been developed really significantly in Canada and Australia and to some extent the UK, with very frequently a lot of pension fund money attached to it. I would say that the agenda, there's been a kind of a neoliberal agenda of privatizing a lot of what has been public infrastructure. And in a very strange way, the Canadian funds and other pension funds, now Ulico and others in the U.S., are starting to pick up on what Canadian and Australian funds have pioneered, which is to sink their billions and billions of dollars into an area that, frankly, the public sector unions in all of our countries, an agenda that we've been trying to resist. You know, we actually try to defend and keep public infrastructure in public and democratically accountable hands, both because it's often serving as an employer, but also because it's providing really vital services or functions for the general public on a not-for-profit or not entirely commercialized and commodified basis. These transformations, you know, I would make the case that what you're looking at JFK is the agenda for the next 10 years to the tune of hundreds of billions, possibly trillions of dollars, is to be geared into all of the airports, all of the energy, electricity grids, water systems, highways, railways, transportation networks. I think the financial world is looking at this as their resolve to the quest for a rate of return that they want to continue to generate.
This comports with what purports to be a Trump infrastructure plan. There was that thin document that Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro drew up during the campaign. Nothing much has come of it, but their idea was to use private funds, private equity funds, to revitalize the American infrastructure, which may sound good to some people. You know, well, we don't have to bring taxpayers into it. We can use all this pension fund money. But now, what's the downside of this?
Right. Well, I mean, the downside in part is that when we see infrastructure privatized, we see major problems. There is all kinds of evidence and serious research done by organizations like the Public Sector Research Unit in the UK on the history of water privatization, electricity privatization, transportation, rail, now the post office. And the record is just abysmal. Service level goes down. Competition, when it's introduced, generates its own problems. And ultimately, access to the infrastructure becomes rationed by a price mechanism. And to really make this point more dramatically, in fact, where this role of pension funds in infrastructure privatization has been pursued most fully and to most devastating consequence is in the global south, in places like Chile. And more recently, Brazil, where governments have actually opened the door, welcomed foreign institutional investment to come in and take over and operate things like water systems, energy, and so forth. And there are now, in some places, like in Latin America, grassroots social movements, such as in Santiago, Chile, where you have groups that are fighting to retake national control or public, some kind of social public control over, for example, their water system. Because the Canadian pension funds and their management flunkies are running their water system in a way that's going to extract the most money they can from water ratepayers. That's just one illustration. In the U.S., you know, there is a very widespread debate about things like toll highways and the way that toll highways can end up extracting in a very regressive way payments from users of this infrastructure. In a way that is regressively transformative. And I think, you know, writ large, this is bad public policy, in part because as public policy, it is designed to deliver low risk and high return to financial investors.
And just as a footnote to the risk portion, they do design a lot of these arrangements so that the public sector still bears some of the risk and the private sector manages to avoid it.
Absolutely. In fact, in the U.S., even more than in Canada, I've kind of learned about some of the ways that your toll highway contracts have been signed between private operators and governments in the public sector, whereby, for example, a private toll highway owner, when they sign a contract to build, manage, and operate a toll highway, in the contract with a government will be clauses that literally protect them from the threat of what they would call public sector competition. In other words, if a government were to build or improve a highway or a roadway that's nearby the toll highway in a way that would negatively affect their profit, well, they have a claim on a penalty or a compensation for that competition. So in other words, it actually restricts the public sector or the government from quote-unquote, competing with that private interest. These are dream contracts for these private operators that literally, in some cases, guarantee a certain level of revenue and even, in some cases, a certain level of profit. Public guarantee.
And just to underscore the point, there are public pension funds that are putting money into these schemes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this is the really disturbing, from my perspective, the disturbing thing to learn is that the operators, the managers, and asset managers for public pension funds, significantly in Canada, I'd say increasingly in the U.S. and other places, they are now major agents of this agenda, not just the refining and the continued development of this public-private partnership model. But also, I would add, I think there's some recognition that other elements of, you know, what we often call the neoliberal agenda, like trade liberalization agreements, are also helpful and important. And we see some evidence here in Canada that the funds are pursuing public policy that they view as in their interest. And that includes things like investor-state dispute resolution under trade deals and other kinds of restrictions on capital flows and so forth. So these funds, as actors in the global financial market, are becoming, I would say, important players in policy formation in a way that, you know, I would argue, I think we in the labor movements here in Canada would argue is ultimately neoliberal and antisocial.
And since we don't shy away from the big questions here on Behind the News, although we only have a few minutes left, I have an opinion that is not, I don't think, widely shared, but I don't think pension funds of this sort should exist at all. I think we should have a publicly financed retirement system where money in the present goes to pay retirees in the present, and money in the future will go to repay retirees in the future. And there's no reason to build up these gigantic pots of money, which are irresistible temptations for Wall Street and Bay Street in the City of London. What do you think of that?
Well, of course, that is my view as well. Although, as I say, it took me some time to get to that view. But I think what your question raises is our retirement security, our pensions, our commitments to future retired, current and future retired populations, must they be embedded and linked to financial assets and financial markets? And one of the contributions that I made to this book project, co-authored with Sam Ginnin, is a chapter that actually develops the argument that this existing system that is resting on financial markets and financial assets was the result of a kind of strategic wrong turn in North America in the 1950s. And in fact, we have, not only in North America, but in other countries, models for decent, secure pension systems that are not resting on financial assets. But as you put it, they're resting on what we call pay-as-you-go commitments. Current workers and taxpayers can contribute to make sure that current retirees are well provided for. That's a pay-as-you-go kind of system, I would say non-financialized, and there's really no reason that we couldn't organize or reorganize our systems in that direction. Take a big fight, and, you know, this runs against the grain of recent trends, but I really believe more and more strongly that that's the direction we should be moving.
And I imagine that the unions are not really pushing that kind of agenda, are they?
Well, no, I think that's true. Unfortunately, I think a lot of trade unions, in a kind of realpolitik way, you know, reach very pragmatic conclusions about the world we have, what we've inherited. However, I would say there is, in a positive way, a recognition that, you know, these financial markets are wild and risky and not a basis for security. And I think there is, I can speak more for the Canadian labor movement, I think there is a curiosity and a certain amount of appetite to think through how might we move this in a different direction? How might we get out of this problem? Because on the current trajectory, we're not about to turn it around. And I think, you know, the argument that I make is what we need to imagine is a program that would think about a problem like retirement security on a class-wide basis, rather than, as we've been doing for 60 years, thinking about it in workplace level or trade union sort of sectional way. Instead, we think, how do we do this for everyone equitably and securely? And I think as soon as you make that step, you realize you've got to go to a public universal system that logically does not need to be embedded in the financial markets.
That was Kevin Skerritt, a researcher with the Canadian Union of Public Employees and one of four co-editors of The Contradictions of Pension Fund Capitalism, published by Cornell University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, Opus 38, Number 5, performed by Daniel Barenboim. And now I'm going to turn my microphone over to Liza Featherstone and Jane McAlevey to consider the strengths and weaknesses of the Me Too movement a little over a year after Harvey Weinstein got busted. This is a sequel to a conversation they had on this show last December. Is naming and shaming enough? Is it getting to the right people? Is it building women's power? Or do we need more things like hands off, pants on to do that work? Jane McAlevey is a longtime union organizer, writer, and frequent Behind the News guest. Her most recent book is No Shortcuts. Liza Featherstone writes an advice column for The Nation. Her most recent book is Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation from Aura Books. Ethics require that I disclose that she's also my wife. Liza Featherstone and Jane McAlevey.
I'm Liza Featherstone, and this is Jane McAlevey, and we're going to talk about Me Too. It's been a year since Harvey Weinstein was justly taken down by many women in Hollywood who had had horrible experiences in his workplace, and a lot has happened and a lot has not happened since then.
Yeah, that's true. A lot, both ways, sadly. And it's also been, I think it was probably not until December or so when we first sat down and had a conversation about this very topic. So it's also sort of touching base and reflecting back on the reflections that we had last year, a couple months in, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we raised some questions, I think, and some issues back in December last year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both assessing them, what's changed, what hasn't.
Yeah. And one of the things that we really were struck by when we talked about this last December was the problems of a purely shame and blame, purely legalistic approach to this issue for the left. We talked about the fact that really, when you're talking about calling these important crimes out, that resonates so much more with some publics than others. And it doesn't necessarily hurt some of the worst offenders.
Yeah.
Like, I think at the time we noted Donald Trump, you know,
that these
kinds of allegations haven't hurt him in the least. They may have even helped him become president of the United States or CEO of the World Bourgeoisie, or whatever it is that he is.
Defender of embassy murders. He's got a different title each day, but it is super crucial that in December last year we were already seeing a little bit of what we've seen more of, I think, right? Which is that you're right to your point. This still has not in any way hurt or affected Trump.
Right.
And if we fast forward, though we may not want to get to the Kavanaugh hearings stuff yet, plenty to chew on there. But what we've seen is essentially at least two major men with, let's say, super serious structural power over all women, girls, let alone many other things, namely the President of the United States, and now a sitting Supreme Court justice, where there's been really actually no impact on their ability to hold office and do damage for decades to come, at least in the case of Kavanaugh, right? Whereas, because I think you were saying, you know, last year you pointed out that because our base does care about these issues and take them much more seriously, it's almost bizarre that we're seeing a sort of, at least in the political world, we're seeing a disproportionate amount of, again, no judgment on the accusations on them.
Sure.
But just as a straight sort of political outcome, the Attorney General of New York, the Office of the Attorney General, Senator Franken, again, no judgment on the actual accusations. But because our side is so quick to demand that people just step down for an accusation.
Right. Whether proven or not.
Yeah.
And no matter how serious.
The political consequence is really interesting because we have men on the right, whose base seems to not care very much about this,
who may even approve,
right? And in the case of the Kavanaugh hearings, we know already. I mean, there's certainly some indication it's going to lead to a higher turnout at the polls, right?
Yeah.
Via
among Republicans,
angry male, and women who support angry men or something faction of our society. So it's both not stopping them, and they're in very structurally powerful positions. And if we looked at Democratic Party, loosely speaking, sort of men, who have fallen very quickly, who were also in structurally powerful positions, it's like a net, there's like a loss on one side of structural power by forces that were more progressive. Up against super dangerous, powerful men for whom this is having no impact at all in the political arena. And that's, I want to get this really, Liza, because you, Liza, were saying a few minutes ago before we started recording that, why don't you make the point you're making about the cultural, like who else is falling?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we also see a lot of men falling in the cultural realm. Again, like this is a liberal realm. So we see like, you know, heads of opera houses and ballet companies and orchestras and people in the art world. And it's not that female culture workers don't deserve justice. Of course they do.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to see is that this is really an effective accusation in a liberal milieu.
Right.
And very effective.
Right.
Like this is like like any accusation is right now a really good way to take a powerful man down. And again, you know, not to judge, many of them deserve it, but what we're seeing that it precisely does not do, it does not take down right-wing men who have not only raped women, and quite egregiously with quite credible accusations, and have institutional political agendas that will absolutely result in thousands of women suffering abuse every single day.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know,
right, and again, certainly in the case of Kavanaugh, for decades to come, right?
For decades.
So, yeah, so there's such a mismatch between, I think we were already concerned last year, and we continue to be concerned about sort of naming and shaming as a strategy.
Right.
You know, period, just for lots of reasons. It's,
yeah.
It's clearly only going to work for a certain kind of man, and they happen to be playing out mostly in a more liberal sort of cultural arena.
Right.
It's certainly, we're certainly not seeing a ton of corporate CEOs falling all over the country.
Yeah.
We're just not in outside of the sort of cultural arena, right, including media. But, and believe me, there's no shortage of sexual harassment going on inside the halls of CEOs of Fortune 500. And
of course.
You know what I mean? So, but that's
and it doesn't have that kind of, the accusations don't have that kind of power in those arenas.
Right.
And, you know, you say like, okay, you know, so you take down the head, the pervy head of the ballet company, he'll probably be replaced, you know, by a woman or by somebody who, you know, behaves better. It's fine. It's rather low stakes. But when you extend this to the political realm, if the Republicans manage to use these accusations against Keith Ellison, for instance,
correct?
I mean,
which it, apparently they are, because in just the last few days, he's falling 7 points behind in the polls.
That is like a black man with Bernie Sanders politics not becoming Attorney General of Minnesota. Those are extremely high stakes.
He's going to lead to policies which will negatively affect girls, children, people, women, all of it.
Look, at the end of the day,
the institutional policies of the extreme corporate populist-fronted right-wing right now are devastating. They're devastating.
Like, our planet cannot survive them, and many individual humans cannot survive them either.
Yeah. So let's, if it makes sense, although I think we should feel free to come back and forth at any point on any of these topics, but so one thing is we're still looking at naming and shaming, right? That's still, we're still, the country's still obsessed with like the idea that naming and shaming works for sexual harassment for some people, but of course it didn't work for Dr. Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh sitting on the Supreme Court and any idea that they were going to change their mind. I mean, I felt like
it was never
having, it was so interesting. Some of the same people who asked me, you know, did I think Trump was going to win 6 months before Trump won, literally some of the same people were ringing me up and saying, okay, so you predicted this right last time. Like, we're sure Kavanaugh's not going to get in now. So what do you say? And I, from day one, I said, no, this is absolutely not going to stop Kavanaugh's appointment. I mean, you just, it's like liberal and wishful thinking versus power structure analysis.
Right.
They were never going to not put Kavanaugh on.
Right.
Certainly not the way that the tactical maneuvering was happening from the Democratic
right.
Party, which...
Can you give our listeners the Jane McAlevey power analysis of the Kavanaugh hearings? Why was this Democratic strategy here doomed to fail?
It's probably less fresh in my brain than it was when I was fuming about it during the hearings.
And yes, I remember you were beside yourself.
as were millions of people across the planet.
Well, we were all
right?
beside ourselves, but you were beside yourself in a way that was additionally informed by the fact that you do understand how power works.
There were so many, like, even just the questioning. I mean, this is just... pathetic. The entire Kavanaugh process was pathetic. First of all, what I certainly don't know the real facts about are why Feinstein's office sat on this for as long as they did.
Right.
I can only guess at this point, and I'm going to guess that they were concerned because they, deep down, some of them understand power, actually, and they understood mm-hmm. what we do, which is that Kavanaugh was not...
The accusation would not stop him. Right.
So I think, I'm guessing that tactically they thought if they did hold it till close to the election... that a delay call for an investigation would actually get them past the midterms. So that's one set of, like, poor tactical decision-making.
Right.
Because the truth is, she was so unbelievably compelling. I mean, she was extraordinary. And
incredible.
Had it unfolded strategically differently, tactically differently, there might have been a strategy that actually led to the kind of investigation that you might have had... independent investigators had enough time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally,
mm-hmm.
like people might have actually gone.
Right.
Like, literally... hackers, online folks, the best investigative journalists and people that we know. Like, we as a movement have the ability to do serious investigations, and with 5 days on a time clock, like, it was just not possible to go do many of those things. So, at so many levels, it was ridiculous, including even during the actual hearing, the day of the testimony, I just remember wanting to jump off a roof or something, because she was amazing. They were, the Republicans were extremely strategic, you know, they thought they were anyway, they were bringing in this other woman to do the questions. And then, like, every time it turned to, like, the Democrats do, like, their questions, they spent, like, they had 3 minutes each, right? 2 minutes or 3 minutes, with, like, a time clock going, grassy, like, a time clock going on them. And they spent 3 minutes
grandstanding and congratulating
themselves and how proud they were of her to come forward and thank you and how proud and your voice is being heard. And, you know, no, it's like if you want to actually take the man down, like actually start asking the kind of questions, like when they were questioning him,
right.
too, it was like they just had no, there was no strategy about either asking her questions that would lead to let her repeat and say very important things that she had to say. Like, they were just, like, taking it for 3 minutes, like, you were hurt. It was like a bunch of men making up for feeling bad about what they did to Anita Hill in the speeches they gave to Dr. Ford. And I don't even want to waste that much time thinking about it, because it was just another example of really bad strategy in a moment that really, really mattered.
Yeah.
Every one of these moments really, really matters.
That was the voice of the writer and organizer Jane McAlevey in conversation with the writer Eliza Featherstone.
It makes me think about the broader strategy, right? And
shifting
to think about what have we done since then. So the most visible sort of sign of this is sort of Me Too/Time's Up. And my concern last year is no different now than it was then. It's just even maybe more so, which is for a bunch of structural reasons, right? Because I want to think about structural issues, structural solutions, structural issues, structural challenges. If you look at sort of what our side is doing, one is we're still basically doing naming and shaming. And it's having an effect, as you wisely point out, Liza, it's mostly having an effect on progressives, you know, who can be forced to step down and not the right.
Yeah.
And then we also know it's bringing out the right wing to, you know, to the midterm elections. Okay, so that's problematic. But on our side, the other main face of it, besides sort of the formal naming and shaming that goes on, is the Time's Up sort of movement. And they are primarily about, as they themselves will say, two things. One is they're raising money for public relations campaigns and for lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And with Kavanaugh on the court, I think we need to remind ourselves the courts are gone.
Yeah.
I mean, we just need to say the courts are functionally gone.
Yeah.
There has been the sort of advocacy approach that I've been very critical of for my whole adult life that sort of grew out of the early 1970s, grew out of the Warren Court. It grew out of the shadows of a very different moment in America and a very different Supreme Court. And so liberals, progressives and liberals came to rely on believing, because of the Warren Court's history, that we were going to have this fair judicial process.
Right.
And so most of our strategies around gender equity, and now the Time's Up stuff is like, it's around lawsuits.
Yes, exactly.
The courts are gone.
Yeah.
I just want to say this.
Yeah.
McConnell's appointed 27 more in the deal with Mitch McConnell, I mean, in the deal with Schumer, between now and the midterms.
Right.
We're going to do 26 more federal appellate courts. have appointed more permanent federal judges in the appellate level in the Supreme Court than any Congress ever.
Yeah.
So the courts are gone.
Yeah.
And we don't feel it yet because they haven't overturned all the big cases that they're about to start overturning.
Right.
And then in addition to that, when you think about time's up and the solution is we're raising public relations funds and we're raising money for lawyers. So one is the judges are gone in terms of, like, yeah. the highest level of the judges. As
yeah.
things hit the highest levels, the important cases will just be overturned. So that's
yeah.
getting us nowhere. And then in addition to that, the decision that we were talking about last year when we were doing this discussion was the Murphy Oil case.
Right.
Which is super real, and it was just hitting this, it had
yeah,
just been heard
right.
at that point. So that was, and we were right about that, right? Like, that got
yeah.
merged into a ruling called the Epic Systems ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And on May,
yeah,
I think it was 26th, Epic Systems, so Murphy Oil got rolled into Epic. Three cases got rolled into one omnibus decision at the Supreme Court in May, very
mm-hmm.
end of May. May 26, mm-hmm. I think, was the ruling. And I was just reading the dissenting brief on it for some of the research I'm doing, and it's so astounding. So what was Murphy Oil becomes Epic, and essentially it says many things, including there's no ability to take class action lawsuits functionally in this country. And most of the, as you well know from the work
yeah.
you did, and you should take
yeah.
us back to that, right,
yeah.
to the Walmart case and more,
yeah.
but like, so much of what was done historically on gender-related claims came from legal strategies and class action lawsuits.
That's right. That's right.
And that's literally gone now because
yeah.
Epic Systems says yeah. That any corporation, small company, mom-and-pop company, anyone, any employer can now force you to sign what's called an individual arbitration agreement when you're hired. And this is all new. This is since May. And people do not get this yet.
Yeah, yeah.
It means that you are bound by the terms of the individual arbitration agreement, which prevents you from class action lawsuits, prevents you from even having a lawsuit, prevents you from
even
in many
like
cases,
an individual,
yes,
right.
and in many cases makes you pay for the settlement cost. Like I've been reading some of them. It literally means the courts are really, really gone.
Yeah.
Because in many of the companies are making people sign documents they don't understand at all. You know, you get your health insurance, oh, my health insurance. You get whatever. You get a bunch of forms to sign, and then you know you start signing papers. And some of them are absolutely incredible. I mean, you can't talk about it in public. You can't talk to your coworkers about it. So if you have a claim, you're not even allowed to talk to a coworker about sexual harassment.
Right.
Because that's a violation of the agreement. You can be fired for that. And then you can't sue over it. So the Epic Systems ruling, like in the labor movement broadly speaking,
a massive victory for capital.
Massive, right? Massive. And
yeah.
and really in the topic of, I mean, it, on this issue is going to leave many of the strategies that Time's Up has so far come up with, render them completely
bleached. Nonsensical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and I think people don't get it because there was so much energy focused on the Janus ruling in
mm-hmm.
the broader labor world.
Yeah.
And it was, to me, the most anti-worker ruling in maybe decades was actually Epic Systems. And
mm-hmm.
people don't, and I really mean that. Like, it's
mm-hmm.
a profound attack on workers' rights, not
yeah.
whether or not workers can pay dues to the union treasury. Like, that's
right.
that's an attack on unions.
Right.
An attack
right.
on workers in this country is called Epic Systems.
Right.
And in
right.
fact, what it's going to mean is the only women in this country who can actually credibly have any mechanism in the workplace to go after male bosses who are abusing them, or coworkers, or guests in the case of hotel workers or something, the only people in this country, the only women in this country who have any ability to stop harassment in the workplace is if women form a union.
Mm-hmm.
Because a union will get you around
right.
the Epic ruling.
Right.
Because if you have a union contract,
right.
then you don't have to sign an individual arbitration agreement. So
right.
it's literally like a crazy right. endorsement of
right.
unions.
And you might be able to prevent some of this you know, from even having to go to a lawsuit because you might be able to stop it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that too. But
yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's like Epic Systems means everyone who doesn't have a union should really be forming one.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the estimate I read the other day is that already 55% of all of the workers of America are now under individual agreements. Like, since the ruling came down in May, major corporations that didn't have it are forcing everyone to sign them.
Right.
So the strategy of, like, we're raising money for lawsuits is nothing. It's not a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas organizing unions is still something you can do.
It actually is something you can do.
actually,
and
yeah.
people are actually winning. You know, I was just reading
yeah, let's
about
talk about that.
Well, there's a bunch of
yeah.
things, but even just organizing, like 2,000
yeah.
workers just at United in the food service department just formed a union with United here. Like, that's a lovely win.
Mm-hmm.
I was just reading about, like, the daily little victory blog today about a bunch of workers who are actually forming new unions.
Mm-hmm.
But what's also interesting to me in the last year is that still where the biggest victories are happening when it comes to, like, serious gender equity issues. which includes sexual harassment, but go well beyond sexual harassment, right? Mm-hmm. Are some amazing trade union campaigns. And I think the one that is not getting nearly enough attention is the one called Hands Off Pants On.
Yeah, yeah. So talk about that.
Hands Off Pants On was, people, if they do know about it, they've just heard about the Chicago Hotel Ordinance, maybe. But essentially, Hands Off Pants On, which is just
such a great name.
Yeah. Was started by the union that is right now leading some, helping to lead some very powerful strikes across the country. There's a nine-city strike against the Marriott Hotel Corporation, which we should all be supporting with every, you know, go to the picket lines, go support them. Like, it's a great strike. It's a very important strike. So that same union, long before we heard the name Harvey Weinstein in connection with egregious behavior, that we had heard his name before, right, as a Democratic Party donor and a star of sorts, but before we knew his name as a deleterious, disgusting character, long before his name surfaced, this campaign in Chicago from the union began saying that women needed the right to do two things. One was have a panic button, and these are not just panic buttons, like some fake little make-you-feel-good go noise goes off. They're GPS, these are serious panic buttons, like that are now, by law, the union campaigned to pass a law that mandates that every single hotel worker in a giant convention city now has panic buttons attached to their uniforms that have GPS on them, that have a noise on them, that immediately there's people staffing a desk that watch them. Like, it wasn't like that. It was, like, really implemented really well. Not just, like, no enforcement, no, you know what I mean? It was, like, a really well-done ordinance.
Yeah.
Led by the union. And what's so important is it began long before the Harvey Weinstein revelations began.
Right.
So, like, trade unions were already out there coming up with real solutions for ordinary working women in this country who have no real solutions if they don't have a union.
Right.
So the campaign is spreading. The ordinance is now on the ballot in Long Beach. It's on the ballot. It looks like it's going to pass overwhelmingly, I think, in Oakland, in the city of Oakland. And the ordinances are growing now. They're actually becoming more gender equity broadly, not just panic buttons and safety and security, because they're adding in higher wages. They're adding in a bunch of other issues into the ordinances, and they're passing. But a key thing about trade unions as a solution here in the power analysis is they also, both through negotiations and the ordinances, are ensuring that, like, when women actually make a complaint about an employer harassing them, they have to be taken seriously. And a hotel guest, or when a cleaner is cleaning a big building at night and she's left all alone pushing her cart around giant office towers, right? I mean, the most vulnerable women in a consistent way. Farm workers, which is what led to the Time's Up letter to the farm workers, right? So it's like farm workers in the fields, but also many other sectors where it's like a large number of women who, because we have no income supports in this country, and we should get income supports, because we have no way to quit your job and have any safety net in this country, unlike Scandinavia or many other countries, they actually have to be taken really seriously now. And I've been interviewing women who say in the past, until they won the ordinances, until they formed a union, both those things, and the forming of the union led to the ordinances, until they were able to do that, if you were a hotel worker and you had just gotten, the most common thing is men masturbate in front of them. Strip down naked and masturbate, and then ask them to, like, bring them a washcloth, like, when they're in the room. Like, can you get, like, the stories are just, it's in excess of 50% of hotel worker women who have really horrific experiences almost every day. Like, when I said to them, so is this, like, once a month, when I was interviewing someone the other day, and they said, some striking Marriott workers, and they said to me, they all just, like, looked quizzically at me, and they said, like, it's daily. Oh, it's daily that men, like, masturbate in front of them, open the door, take their robe off, walk around naked, and or do far worse than that. But, like, clearly weird, horribly sexual harassment going.
Yeah,
and so, unless they don't have a union, if they complain, they can either just be immediately fired because the company's more interested in keeping a hotel guest than a housekeeper. So they just get summarily fired, or they get told to leave. Or they just switch it out and they'll call up a different one and send her up the next day. So under all these ordinances, part of them is that they're compiling lists of, like, you know, men who perpetuate really offensive behavior. But the thing that's most exciting is they actually have a way to get people, like, get bad managers fired. I just interviewed someone who I'm writing about who they wound up getting a very horrible assistant manager who was systematically harassing very vulnerable, given their jobs, female workers fired. So, you know, it's like a union contract. And then, of course, the Glasgow women's strike. I mean, we actually saw a full-on strike by women, like women workers in the city of Glasgow, and there's been a big build-up to it. They've won in the courts, and not just like the courts are gone everywhere. They've won in the courts years ago, a ruling that said that they had to get equal pay for equal work. Mm-hmm. And the largest city in Scotland just wouldn't enforce it. So they just walked out, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like literally a multi-union woman strike, and it was 100% out. People were out. So to me, the solution we have to pay the most attention to is the one we're still paying the least attention to as a progressive movement. We're still having marches and protests, and we're still being naming and shaming, and none of that is actually
talking about babbling about lawsuits.
Yeah,
apparently meaninglessly.
Yeah,
yeah.
When we have real solutions.
Yeah, and I love that we just had a whole conversation about solutions. And even given the time of year it is, we did not once say the word vote. That is so much more creative than most conversations that people are having day to day. Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to say to people that supporting the striking workers right now is at least equally important.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
We got to do base expansion.
Vote, but get on the picket line. The truth is, no matter what happens in the midterms, we still need structural change. So that's why we need to think seriously about power, organize unions, go on strike, and go support those merit workers on the picket line.
Those were Eliza Featherstone and Jane McAlevey. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Adventures Close to Home by the Slits. Till next week, bye. Let's go.